what I wanted to do today is cover some background, and we'll just see how far we can get in the book of Jonah. I don't like to set a goal that when I've got to get to this verse, but I will try to keep us on track. We're not. I like hunting appropriate rabbits. But we want to stay on track. But it helps to do some background first. I'm not going to belabor this a long time, but I like to think about this at the beginning of a Bible study, and this is just some high-level thoughts. But you can read without reading effectively. And you can read the Bible and not read it effectively. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and I'm just going to touch on a few ideas. But, you know, the key question when I study a book of the Bible, I want to know the author's intended message for his original audience. The secondary question is the so what? I mean, what does it mean for me? But when I look at a book like Jonah, I've got to figure out who was his audience and some more information before we can decide what Jonah means. I picked Jonah because most people think Jonah is an easy book. I'm gonna show you that maybe not so much so. But tips for learning the Bible. One is a literal or plain sense hermeneutic. I don't look for secret codes in the Bible. I'm not looking at the letters and saying, well, this letter is going to stand for the number 3, and this letter is the number 7, and I'll add them up and get some secret code. That's numerology. We don't do that. God speaks plainly. A lot of people don't speak plainly. Politicians don't speak plainly. God calls it a spade a spade, and he does it in language that's intended for us to understand it, so that in Deuteronomy 6, he says, I want you to teach this to your children. Well, the children can get it. We can too. But we're going to get it because God speaks plainly, and that's important. Read the whole book before you really bear down to study a book. Jonah, Romans, I don't care what the book is. You've actually got to read it. It's interesting how often people will study a part of the Bible in a way they wouldn't even do with a movie. You can't imagine, you know, going and starting a series of movies, but you start with in the middle of the third movie and in the middle of one of the sequels. Like, that would be absurd. But how often does a Bible study or even a sermon begin somewhere out in the middle without regard to what came first? And not only that, if you'll read Jonah over and over and over, you'll see things come to light. If you have Jonah open, let me just show you an idea of what I'm talking about. Like, things sort of pop up to the surface that maybe you would otherwise miss because you haven't read it enough. When you've read John about 30 times through the Gospel of John, now you're ready to actually think about what he's talking about in chapter 2. And the reason I say that, because these things just start coming to the surface about what's really going on here. Jonah is right after Obadiah, if that helps you find it. Right? Look at verse 2. God says, arise, go to Nineveh. See that word, arise? Arise, go to Nineveh. Now, you skip down a little bit in the same chapter, and the captain of the ship comes to him, and look what he says. Verse 6. Jonah's down in the ship sleeping, you know, when the storm comes. What's the fur? He asks a question, like, what meanest thou, in the King James, O sleeper? Why are you asleep? We're all about to die. Arise. God's reminding him of his disobedience. He can't even hide. Look in chapter 3. Now, he meets with God again. This is, when we have big failings in life, God usually brings us back where we started. Right, he brings us back to the point of failure to try to restore us there. And he says in chapter 3, verse 2, arise. There it is again. Well, how do these things jump out at us? They jump out at us because we read through the book several times. All I'm saying, those little connection points, every book in the Bible is a very well-organized, well thought out book, and it all ties together cohesively. A lot of modern scholars say, no, there were multiple authors, and it's just sort of, you know, it's not really God's word and all that. It's nonsense. When you read the book, it becomes more and more obvious how much it ties together. Words matter. If you assume what a word means, you know, you get in trouble, and we do this more often than we think. I've caught myself several times when I've learned that, you know what, it doesn't mean what I thought it meant. You know, an easy one, you know, especially lots of words we hear a lot. Let me give you an example. especially as Baptists, if I say so-and-so is saved, every one of us is going to assume I'm talking about that person's going to heaven and not hell. But 53% of the time in the New Testament, that word for save has nothing to do with heaven or hell. When Jesus heals people, that's the Greek word used. When someone is asleep and they wake up, same word. That has nothing to do with going to heaven or hell. And so it's just to say, we have to be careful about our words. Genre matters. We'll talk a little bit about what kind of literature is Jonah. Like, when you read Jonah, it reads like a history book. Just very matter of fact. Like the book of Acts, a history book. Other books of the Bible don't read that way. We're studying Revelation in the church service. In a sense, it's relating history. It's history future. But it's a totally different kind of literature. So that will matter. The structure of the book will matter. And I'll show you a bit of an outline for Jonah. Jonah is not a hard book to outline because the chapters are kind of where the divisions are. But a lot of times in our Bibles, that's not true. When you're reading John 8, where Jesus deals with the adulteress, and then he's talking to people outside the temple. Then in John 9, he heals a blind guy. Then in John 10, he's talking about sheep. Those chapter breaks aren't breaking the unit. That's all one big unit of thought. And it kind of can throw us off. So when we start seeing how the book's organized, it'll help a lot. Context is critical. So we're going to park there in a minute, some context. Like, Jonah happens at a point in time in real history. And thankfully, we know a lot about that point in time. And I'm going to show you some of it on some pictures. God's word has to be experientially learned. Years ago, I got asked a question by someone in a class I was teaching, and I couldn't answer it then, which shows I didn't know nearly what I thought I knew, but it was the right question. She said, how is it that Solomon could be the wisest man, the wisest king ever? God said, I give you more wisdom than anyone's ever had, and his life was a mess. Now, what's your answer?
I don't think you're that wise. You have to know why.
Well, but if you had asked him, if you're right, if you had asked him, though, is it acceptable for a king to have 1,000 wives? And what would he have said?
Obviously, he said yes.
You think?
He wrote the word. He changed the meaning of a word by changing a letter.
But the Old Testament had prohibited, not necessarily prohibited him to have two wives. I mean, like, we don't even see David getting criticized for that. But it had prohibited him from multiplying wives. In other words, having a huge harem. But that harem led him to all kinds of false worship and all that. And all I'm saying is, like, there was a disconnect between what you know and what you do. And if you don't do what you know, then you don't know it. Right. I mean, you know, when I was young, I can't remember a time when we ever had a car and took it to a mechanic. We never had a lawn service. So by the time I was 12, I fixed cars, I roofed the house, I painted the house, and I did the lawn every week. And it's just, I mean, I didn't know there was some other way. Apparently, there's people that would do those things for you. Who knew? Now, I learned a little bit about working on cars from my father, because we got out there, and he always drove old cars. They never had air conditioning. We didn't have air conditioned car until I was like 16. But I'm out there, and it, you know, when I'm four, I'm just the guy that holds the light, you know, that is, and hands them the wrenches. But I learned this stuff. Suppose you had read the entire, and I hope you know this, what this phrase means, the entire Chilton manual on working on that 1963 Corvair. You read the whole thing. Are you a good mechanic now? Why not? You've got to do it. The Word of God's that way, okay? You're not a good mechanic with the Word of Righteousness until you've actually lived it out. And so, you know, just, we're always going to come back when we're studying, even, you know, here in Jonah. What am I going to do with this? Because I don't do something with it. We can delude ourselves into thinking that we've arrived at some level of maturity that we haven't, simply because we know a lot about what the manual says about how to address different problems in life. We've just never done it. Our goal is to think biblically. When I say that, think biblically, what does that mean to you? What do you think? What would it mean to think biblically? If I don't think biblically, on what basis will I think?
Worldly.
Yeah. Right. None of us come to our relationship with Christ already being good. Jesus doesn't clean his fish before he catches them. And so we bring in all this baggage, and it's worldly stuff. And for another time, we could go to James 3 and read about two kinds of wisdom that James will talk about in his little epistle. Wisdom from the world and wisdom from God. Wisdom from the world, he says, is devilish or demonic. And you can see it in what it produces in the life of a person. And all I'm saying, you're gonna think on the basis of one or another. Charles Ryrie is a theologian of a prior generation, but he always tell the people in his class, gentlemen, we need to learn to think biblically. Just because you know the Bible doesn't actually mean you think biblically. It has to do something Paul calls in Romans 12, renewing your mind, where he says to be transformed by the renewing of the mind. So anyway, that's the goal. When you study the Bible, we want to think biblically, and Jonah gives us a whole lot to think about. So some big picture, just, and this is just beyond Jonah, anytime we're in the Old Testament, anytime we're looking at any of the writings, you know, after Moses, especially the prophets like Jonah, having some idea of the big picture. God makes a covenant with Israel, right? And this covenant is through Moses, as he's their mediator. Sometimes we call that the Old Covenant or the Law or the Mosaic Covenant. And we won't read Exodus 24, but I just want to say when Moses recounts this law to the nation of Israel, it's like a contract. It's like he's reading the term. Sometimes people will say it fits the pattern of an old suzerainty treaty. It's a treaty between a sort of a ruler or a noble and his people. But God takes on some obligations. They take on some obligations, and they say, yes, we'll do it. It's a deal. Now, that gives you a couple of things you can think about from that. One is, I'm not Jewish. That's not my contract. And it never was. But it was their contract. And in a modern day, when you breach the contract, someone can sue you and take you to court. God doesn't have to do that. He's already the judge in the court, and he's able to enforce it. So we'll look at something in a minute about that. Every prophet in the Old Testament is writing in the context of this covenant between God and Israel. And every prophet is basically saying, you're not keeping your end of the deal. And here's what's going to happen to you. So we'll look at that in a second. So, but in the big picture, Israel's going to be blessed if it's obedient to the law. Okay? And that includes material blessings. That includes security. God says, I'll fight your fights for you. You'll have some bad guys that are going to come in here and they're going to try to get you, and I'm going to deal with them. But if you don't do these things, you don't keep all that I've told you to do, I'm going to let them come get you. And so I want to look at just one chapter. Find Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28 is one of the most important chapters in the Old Testament to understanding the prophets. Deuteronomy 28. And it's a long chapter, so I won't read the whole thing, but it's good to always go back and think about this chapter when you read these prophets saying, here's all the bad things you've done, and here's what God's going to do to you. So, very long chapter. But the way the chapter opens, it says, "If it shall come to pass, if you'll hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, then the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all the nations of the earth." Are they above all the nations of the earth now? Not really. Small piece of real estate that's not the land that God promised them. It's just a piece of the land God promised them, a very small piece. It's about the length of a ride from Galveston to Huntsville. We go through all verse 2, all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. Blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of thy body. That means they're going to have lots of babies. The fruit of the ground, they're going to have lots of watermelons. The fruit of thy cattle, the increase, so they're going to have lots of hamburgers. I mean, this is pretty good. And in their culture, where we're talking pre-money for the most part, this is wealth. a crop, a bunch of strong sons. This is wealth. God says, I'm going to make you wealthy. By the way, he doesn't promise us that, does he, as Christians? Right? Jesus had to get the tax money out of a fish, right? New Testament. But as you read on, though, I'm just going to, and just to get you the idea, you know, I'm going to go up to verse 45. Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee. Like, there was a big shift in the balance of this chapter. Verse 45, all these curses shall come upon thee and shall pursue thee and overtake thee till thou shalt be destroyed because you hearkenest not unto the voice of the Lord thy God to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded thee. And he goes through these, and basically what he does is much the way we might parent. There's consequences when a child does something wrong, but if they continue doing that same thing over and over, let's say they're lying about something, the consequences are probably going to step up. And God says, you know, I'm going to do things like I'm going to turn the rain off. I can do that. I can just, it ain't going to rain, right? And if that doesn't work, I'll do this. And if that doesn't work, I'll do this. But eventually, I'm going to bring a people whose language you don't understand, and they're going to start cracking heads together, and you're not going to like it, you know. So just understand, when we're reading something like Jonah and any of the other writing prophets, God's not just shooting out of left field saying, this is, you know, you did bad, I'm going to do this. You didn't keep your part of the bargain, right? Now, are we bound by this law today, this Mosaic law? Does that bind me as a Christian today? Maybe a rabbit trail that we don't want to go, but I want to ask the question.
Yes.
All of it?
No, not even Jews were obligated to all of it, because there's law for women,
sure,
law for the priests, there's law for men, there's law for the sojourners in the land.
That's right.
So, some of it.
Some of it. And what about the covenant? Like, if you look at the whole system as a covenant between God and Israel, is that covenant still in place?
Yes.
No. Yeah. Everybody agree? Okay. We'll fish down that trail another day. When you read the writing prophets, they especially have that material. And Leviticus 26 is like Deuteronomy 28. They had that material there. Well, in the history of Israel, you know, the original plan was not to have kings. And we have a book called The Judges, for example, and it shows you how well that worked. The end of the book of Judges kind of says everybody did what they thought was right in their own eyes because there was no king, which meant they just, without human government, they felt like they could do anything they wanted. So they get a king. They pick Saul because he looked presidential, right? That's how a lot of people vote. People look, they always hear that around election time. Well, he looks presidential. That's how you got Saul. David comes after him. They didn't pick David. Who picked David? Yeah. God picked him. And he's not even the one Samuel would have picked. Samuel was the prophet, the last judge. He was sent there to anoint the king. And Jesse brings out all his big strapping boys. He doesn't bring out David because it can't be David. Can't be him. Yeah. And God's like, what? I see the heart. That's my paraphrase. That's what he tells Samuel. Because even Samuel doesn't understand it. He didn't look presidential. Samuel didn't know that in his spare time, David wrestled bears and lions with no hunting rifles. But after David, you have Solomon, his son, through Bathsheba. That's the last king of a united nation. And that becomes important for the context of Jonah. So you have one nation that we, at that time in our Bible, would call Israel. David's a king around 1000 BC, this long time ago. Solomon is king by the 970s BC, thereabouts. And so a long time ago. But because of all of Solomon's problems, God splits the kingdom after that. And it becomes what we might think of as the north and the south. The north is often, after that, called Israel. So you have to know, like I'm reading, it says Israel, but it's not the whole nation. It's part of it. And the south is called Judah. Sometimes the north is called Ephraim in our Bible. Sometimes it's called Jacob. I mean, you just have to kind of look at it. But usually, we'll just call it the Northern Kingdom, and it matters because Jonah is a prophet to the north. You'll have three prophets to the north in the Bible, and all the other ones that write books of the Bible are to the south. Mel said this in the service earlier. Prophets do two things. They foretell and they foretell. Foretell is telling the future. That's kind of the cool part, because they tell things that are going to happen down the road. Foretell is the part we don't like. That's when they come and point at us and say, look, God says you are fixing to get your head whacked. Right? Fixing to woodshed you. That's what happened in the old days. Now we get kids little pills, but you know, you only did it once, right? And but that's what they do. And they come and they speak to you to the moment. And that's what Jonah will do. So they may foretell the future or just talk about what's going on. Now what about the city Nineveh? Interesting city, because it's still there. As long as you don't mind vacationing in Iraq, and I know a lot of guys have vacationed there at the government's invitation, but you can vacation in Iraq near Mosul, and that's where Nineveh's at. It's on the east side of the Tigris River. It comes from the word Ninar, Ninua, which apparently had the idea of meaning like a fish town or something. And that starts to make sense when you know the book of Jonah and the fish and all that. You start saying, well, maybe God knew what he was doing when he sent him to these Ninevites. Their cuneiform was like a fish in an enclosure. They worship a fish god named Dagon, kind of a that does seem like a stretch to me. We watch movies about mermaids. This is just a male mermaid, right? I don't know what you would call him, a man-made, a merman or something, but that's what he is. And he has human and fish features. An old city founded way back in Genesis 10, where you start finding another prominent city called Babylon, the seat of human evil from the beginning till now. Long held by the Assyrians. I'll come back and say a little about them, but don't confuse that with modern-day Syria, where we've got all kinds of trouble going on, and you've got that clown that's running the country there. This is a different group of people at a different time, and they make him look like a schoolboy, a little Boy Scout or something. These Assyrians are some bad folks. When Jonah preached, that town of Nineveh had two walls, an inner wall about 50 feet thick and an outer wall 100 feet thick. Not a big city by modern standards, a circumference of 8 miles. That's caused a lot of critics of Jonah when they see right in the opening of the book, God says, go to that great city. And the critics say, well, it's not a big city. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I think it's a big city. They had plague strike, 765, 759 B.C. That matters because I think Jonah probably preaches in the 750s B.C. It's just to place a time marker, and I'll show you why. People would place in maybe 759, 758, you know, we're counting backwards, but that's the time period. When those kinds of things happen, though, plagues hit a city. When they happen here in the United States, we usually don't think, I wonder if God did this. We just say, God bless us. But in the ancient cities, even the pagans knew, if you get plagues one after the other, you know, you start looking, saying, maybe God did this. Maybe, right? And then there was this total eclipse. A lot of these people worship the stars and, you know, astrology and all that. So an eclipse is a big thing. They might have been somewhat primed for Jonah's arrival. There are two mounds on the east side of the Tigris River where we would call Nineveh. One of them has largely not been excavated because it's basically owned by, controlled by Islam. You know, it has a mosque on it. It's called the Mosque of Jonah. They think Jonah went there. Isn't that interesting? If you read the Quran, most of the most of the big stories, not the obscure stuff, but the big stories in our Bibles, Old and New Testament, a lot of that's in there because of the way Muhammad picked up his information on kind of his trade journeys and then just twisted it around. That's what Satan does. He twists things around. To write it, but they have that one mound. But in the 1850s, the British archaeologists went in there on that other mound. Not only did they excavate it, it's all sitting in London in the British Museum, and it's a lot. I mean, Nineveh, this Nineveh we study in the Bible that Jonah goes to, the inside of the castle where perhaps he walked when he talked to the king. All the statues, the records, the pictures, they're there in the British Museum. I'm going to show you a few pictures, but it's, you know, this is real. God's like not just making this stuff up. This is real people at a real time. So you have the mound of Jonah, and you've got the other one where Jonah would have went. Just some quotes about the people of Nineveh, because I think it helps us get an idea. Why is it that when God says to Jonah, go that way, Jonah goes the opposite direction? He's trying to go to Spain, of all places, way in the opposite direction. Well, this guy, Elliot Johnson, is he was a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, and he wrote a little book on Jonah. He said Nineveh was a capital of one of the cruelest, vilest, most powerful, and most idolatrous empires in the world. Gross immorality was practiced in Nineveh and throughout the Assyrian Empire. The religion of Assyria was Babylonian in origin. By the way, all false religions are Babylonian in origin. We may see more of that, you know, down the road with it, but I mean, that's Genesis with the Tower of Babel, right? All false religions come from that. Astrology, all of it. It was Babylonian in origin, but Assyria, in Assyria, the national god was Ashur, whose high priest and representative was the king. Most ancient cultures, the king was considered a god. The Egyptian pharaoh that wouldn't let the people go, a god. He just wasn't a very strong god, as it turns out. But listen to Sennacherib. Now, Sennacherib is an Assyrian king. What will happen is God will let the northern kingdom go first. I said earlier the kingdom split after Solomon. The northern kingdom never has a good king, ever. They're just rotten to the core, and for a lot of reasons, and more into that history. But God never... they're outside the will of God to even be a separate kingdom, and they don't go to Jerusalem to worship as the law required. Men had to go three times a year. There's a lot of things that they couldn't and wouldn't do. And so the kings of the north, they didn't want their people traveling to Jerusalem, so they set up false places of worship. They had their own temple mount. Bethel is their one of their cities of where they would worship. And so all kinds of bad stuff going around, bad kings. In 722 B.C., 40 years after Jonah preaches, God takes them out. He brings the Assyrians, and everything Jonah feared would happen. Jonah thought, if I go preach these Assyrians, just by chance, because God's so good, he'll save them. And then they'll come kill us. And Jonah was right. They did that in 722. Now, this guy comes later. The guy in 722 is a guy named Sargon. When Sargon's gone, they say, well, we've got the north. Let's go take the south. Let's take Jerusalem. This clown Sennacherib comes to take Jerusalem. It was one thing he didn't count on, because he conquers every city but Jerusalem. He counted on one thing that he didn't count on. You know what that was? We know he didn't take Jerusalem.
Hezekiah was a godly king.
Hezekiah goes to God and says, God, I can't do it. I need you to save us. I need you to deliver us. Hezekiah prays to God. God sends who to defeat the Assyrian army? Remember who he sends? It's one of the...
plague.
But he sent one angel. One angel, and he kind of plagues the men, and they get all crazy. That repeats itself, by the way. Like in the end times, God will do that again. You can read about that in Zechariah 14. God has a way of defeating armies. One thing is he just makes them start killing each other. And they do. 185,000 people in a single day. What if he had sent two angels? I mean, that's just one angel. We have such a pompous view of military strength. God can take out the most powerful country in the world back then in a day. He can do it to us. See, but we have this view. Sennacherib, though. This is just some words he wrote. I want you to get the idea of how cruel, bloody, just bad these guys were. I cut their throats like lambs. I cut off their precious lives as one cuts a string. Like the many waters of a storm, I made their gullets and entrails run down upon the wide earth. Their hands I cut off. These people love to hurt people. And very few points in history have seen people quite as bad as they were. The Babylonians probably were not as bad as these guys were. Now, Sennacherib comes... And Hezekiah, by his prayer to the Lord, is able to protect Jerusalem. These guys put everything in a book. He wrote about that incident. You know what he says? He says, I defeated this town and this town and this town, and when I got to Jerusalem, I kept them pent up like a bird in a cage. How is it? And I'll show you the map in a minute. How could you defeat every city you went after except one? And when I don't mean every city like in Israel. I mean every city, but one. I kept them pinned up like a bird No, sir, you went back home with your tail between your legs and put some more women in the harem to cheer you up is what you did. And you wrote about it. But Ashur-Banipal, now why is his name Ashur-Banipal? Well, Ashur is their main god. So they put it in their name. You see that when Daniel's friends get, you know, Daniel himself in the book of Daniel, they get renamed to fold in the Babylonian gods into the names. Now this guy is in the 600s, so he's after Jonah. He says of a captured leader in battle, I pierced his chin with my hand dagger and threw his jaw past a rope, put a dog chain on him, and made him occupy a kennel. He gets the king of that city he's taken and leads him around like a dog. They're bad. God's assessment, Nahum, you know, Nahum's one of our prophets in here with these shorter prophets. Sometimes we call them minor prophets. There are 12 of them. The Jewish people call them the 12. They don't never call them minor prophets. They're minor in the sense that the messages are shorter. Nahum, he speaks to the southern kingdom, to Judah, and his primary message is the Assyrians are not going to take you. They're not going to take you. And he calls Nineveh a city of blood. Nahum's in a sense like the sequel. Jonah goes and the Ninevites live. Nahum preaches and God says, time's up. Like a big hourglass just running down. You know, just like when God took the people to Egypt, the Israelites, and he said, the time of the Gentiles isn't full yet, but when time's up, I'm bringing them out. And just know that about 100 years later, God takes Nineveh out, and now it's a mound of dirt, as it's been for a long time. I know this is kind of a dark image because I have it zoomed in a lot. What's wrong with the guys in the picture? Yeah, they're impelled. There's debate about whether they're impelled before or after. But it's worse than that. Usually they skin them first. Sennacherib attacks Lachish. Lachish is close to Jerusalem. You can find it on a Bible map. He takes Lachish. And so when you're in the British Museum, they have what are called reliefs. They're big flat panels of stone that are engraved with these pictures. And there's a hallway. You can go look at it. Just Google British Museum Assyria, and you can take a virtual tour now. You couldn't do that in the old days, but you can see it all with high-quality images. And you go this long hallway. It's about 50 feet long, and both sides are these reliefs, these stone panels from Nineveh, from the very place where Jonah went. And this is what you see. When you arrived to see the king, and you by the time you got to him, you saw a bunch of this, and you probably did a little repenting of any thoughts you had that you might take him out or anything like that. You know, I'm just telling you, these were bad people, and they're hanging them on a stake. This is what they did to the Jewish people in Lachish. And then they made their way to Jerusalem. Here they are flaying some of the people in Lachish. It's a high, you know, zoom in on it. But you see these guys there, they've got the daggers and got these guys laid out, you know, stripped naked and stretched out. Can you understand? And I'm showing you some pictures that are after Jonah, but this is who they were. So when God says, listen, I want you to go to those Ninevites, you walk right up to that king and you tell him what I said. Really? How would that be today? God comes to you in a vision and says, I'm sending you to Tehran. I want you to go up to the Ayatollah there. You tell him the Jewish God says their time's up. What are you going to do? You might go to Spain. Get on that Carnival cruise ride. All inclusive, get your meals. Because you're worried when you get to Tehran, they're not going to treat you well. This is a king that's just, now this is 744. This is about 15 years after Jonah. Tiglath-Pileser is the king. He's one of their strongest. After him, the kingdom declines. And it's a little hard to see. This is actually a picture I personally took when I was at the museum a long time ago, and the technology wasn't as good. But this king has his foot on the neck of this guy that's bent down, and he's got that spear where he can drive it through his back. That's how they viewed themselves. The other stuff that wasn't about them killing was about them hunting, always hunting lions. There were lions there. There's not any more, but there were lions in that day. And it was a show of their manhood to be able to, you know, kill a lion. This one's gotten too fuzzy. This is the attack that Tiglath is doing on somebody. And these guys have their bow and arrows. It's got their chariot, so we have an idea of what kind of weapons they have. the left side, I wish it was a better picture, it's a ladder set up against the wall, because they have to breach the wall. Ancient cities, if you didn't have a wall, you were a sitting duck. Jerusalem, later in its history, doesn't have a wall, and God says, I'm the wall. But for most of its history, it has a wall, and if you could breach the wall, you've won. Okay? How does God breach walls? Well, think about what happened to Jericho. Just march around and blow a wall up, right? But that's how you conquer a city. You breach the wall. Here's a map, and it's got three levels of green. So you can see the Tigris River labeled, and there's Nineveh on the east side of the Tigris, and there's just a little dark green there. That's where the kingdom starts, and we're talking almost 2000 BC. The light green is how the kingdom has grown, you know, 50 to 100 years after Jonah. And if you look, it's all the way down to Thebes on the Nile River in Egypt. That all that green stuff, he's literally taken everything but Jerusalem, and he's taken the Egyptians, right? And he has control of the Nile River. Control that, control Egypt. So just to say, this is what you're dealing with. It's a world power. Which world power replaces it? Babylon, the Babylonians, right? By around 620, 630 BC, they're much weakened. A guy named Nabopolassar, who is we know Nebuchadnezzar, that's his boy. Nabopolassar takes the Babylonians takes the Assyrians for the most part, and his son takes it over. His son's in Jerusalem in 605 BC. It's when Daniel gets kidnapped, and his friends, and probably a lot of the other rich children, they all get kidnapped. And Nebuchadnezzar learns while he's there in Jerusalem that his father died. That's bad. You need to be by the throne when the king dies, or someone else is going to sit on it. So he rushes back. But you get that wonderful history. And then all this green stuff pretty quickly becomes Babylon. And then Babylon doesn't last a long time. Who comes after that? Yeah, the Medes and the Persians. Babylon falls in about 539 BC. Okay, and then the Medes and Persians come in. Why does God bring them in? They're willing to let all the people go back home. God wants his people back in Jerusalem, and the Medes and Persians will allow that, although most of them don't go. Alexander the Great comes around 330-ish BC. Why does God bring him in? I want everybody in this world to speak one language so I can write the New Testament in that language. We need a common language. Alexander was a genius. He realized that he couldn't lead that those people without a common language. He manufactured one, and we call it Koine Greek. So, you know, God's working in all this. So just we keep an eye on that. The book of Jonah, part of the 12 or the minor prophets, probably the best known. At least people know he was swallowed by a whale or a fish. I put "whale" in quotes because that's not really what it says. But in the King James, the New Testament calls it a whale. Disbelief. This is Charles Feinberg. He's a great Jewish Christian scholar that's been gone for a while, but he has a lot of writings on these prophets. But I like what he says here, because this is true. Disbelief has attacked this book of Jonah probably more than any other. It's weird. Like, you would think maybe they would attack, I don't know, some of the tremendous things you see in the book of Daniel. But Jonah gets attacked by particularly people, we call them critical scholars. They don't really believe the Bible is the Word of God, but for whatever reason they write about it. And they speak to all these things in the book of Jonah that are unbelievable, they say. If God can't send a fish to swallow a dude, he can't resurrect a guy from the dead. I mean, it's not a stretch. But once you decide that, well, all these things in Jonah couldn't happen, what reason do you have to believe anything else? And because people don't want to believe Jonah as just a history book, they'll say, well, Jonah's not a history book. It's an allegory. It's a parable. Jesus taught in parables. But it's not. It's a history book. And Jesus says it's a history book. We'll look at that. The character Jonah has intrigued believers for many centuries. Unfortunately, he's become caricatured by many who miss the positive results of an objective examination of his life. It's a case study of missed blessings because so many readers focus upon its supposed difficulties rather than upon its rich teachings. This is the Southern Baptists put out a series of commentaries in the Old and New Testament called the New American Commentary Series. They're very helpful books. This is the one on Jonah, and that's right. It's a missed blessing. Why? Because people start focusing on, I wonder what kind of fish could do that. you know, was it a sperm whale? I mean, what was it? You know, and they miss it. Well, but this is the most provocative statement, and I stand behind this one. Jonah is probably the most misunderstood book in the Bible. Now, lots of books are the most debated. Like, people debate the Song of Solomon a whole lot. Historically, up until recent times, with very few exceptions, people didn't take the Song of Solomon to really just be a song about a husband and a wife. They took it in all kinds of ways. So it's debated. But this one is just widely misunderstood, I think. And I'll try to show you why. Who's he writing to? Look at 1 Kings. Let's see if I don't have it here. No, I don't. Look at 1 Kings chapter 14. I want to show you something. This will, there's one reference to Jonah, possibly others, but one critical reference to Jonah in the book of 1 Kings.
Chapter 14.
I believe it's chapter 14. I've got it written down on another slide, but it should be chapter 14 and I think verse 25. Hopefully I've got the right one. Let me see here. Hold on. I'm going to go to the next slide. I'll get it. Yep. I said 1 Kings. I was off by a book. Same scroll, second half. 2 Kings 14. Sorry. Verse 25. Look at what he says there. This is a critical to tie. Because if we didn't have this verse, we wouldn't know for sure who this Jonah is and when he spoke. So 2 Kings 14, 25. It starts off, he is Jeroboam the second. I'll say something about him in a moment. The king, Jeroboam the second, restored the coast of Israel. What does Israel mean? It means the northern kingdom. He restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath unto the sea of the plain, according to the word of the Lord God of Israel, which he spake by the hand of his servant Jonah. See, when this Jeroboam is enjoying all this political and success, Jonah told him it would be so. Jonah, the son of Amittai, Amittai is his dad, it means truth teller. The prophet, which was of Gath. Where's Gath at? 4 miles from a city we know better called Nazareth. It's interesting, you know, there's an interesting lesson about Jonah. When you read John 7, 7th chapter of John's Gospel, Jesus has appeared at the temple, and the priest, they have temple guards who they sent to arrest Jesus, but they don't. They come back and they're like, we couldn't do it. No one ever talked like this guy. And one of the priests there, and I think it's probably the high priest, but he says this, don't you know that no prophet ever came from Galilee? Jonah's from Galilee. I'm just saying. So having all the accolades and saying something with great confidence doesn't actually make it true. Jonah is from.
You say it louder.
You say it louder, right? and it's interesting, you know. But here's Jonah, a prophet from there, and I think it's prophetic historical narrative. I say prophetic because it comes from a prophet, but it's historical narrative. When you read all the other prophets. Most of them, it'll say just, you know, God brought the word to me, and then it's a sermon. If red letter Bibles were done the way I would like them done, most of the Old Testament would be in red letters, at least in the prophets, because they say a phrase that happens like 3,500 times in the Old Testament, thus saith the Lord. You'll see that just repeatedly through the prophets, and they are mouthpieces for God. They're not taking what God said and interpreting it. They're dictating what they heard. There are some exceptions where you get some biographical information. Ezekiel chapter 1 talks about how he gets called as a prophet and kind of he was a priest and he turned 30. That's when you would enter the priesthood and a little bit of background. Then he starts preaching. Isaiah 6 talks about the calling of Isaiah. The first half of Daniel gives some biographical information about Daniel and his friends. Those are the exceptions. Most of the prophets are sermons. And yet when you read the book of Jonah, there's no sermon at all. It's like you showed up for church, you sat through the whole service, and you didn't get preached to, right? It's odd, right? Jonah's exceptional in that way. It's a historical narrative with a didactic purpose. His life is the message. And so we have to look at Jonah. It helps to know that the word Jonah means dove. Jonah's the national symbol of Israel. If we had been watching it in the United States, his name would have been eagle. Yeah. And God would have sent him to North Korea, and he would have preached. You know what the North Koreans would have done? The little guy, the little chubby guy that runs the country? He would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. And God would say, I had all this revelation I gave to you, United States, and you squandered it. But I sent one prophet with five words, Jonah's message to the Ninevites is five words, and I sent him to the most cruel, violent people alive, the most idolatrous people alive on the planet. And like a sack of potatoes, they fell apart in sackcloth and ashes. You see how that's convicting? See, it's his life. It's his response to the message. It's everybody else's response. As you read the story, the sailors and everybody we meet in the book of Jonah, that's what it's about. So God uses what transpires in the life of the prophet Jonah to help Israel see its wicked heart. Jonah preaches 40 years before they die. 40 years later, almost to the T, about 39, the Assyrians take them, just destroy them. Jonah's message is 40 days and God's going to take you. This isn't coincidence. This is a picture. See, the book of Jonah never gets given to the Ninevites. The book of Jonah is given to the northern kingdom, and they're reading about a guy whose behavior is shocking. It's like when you hear the Good Samaritan and you've got this guy injured and a Baptist preacher comes along and he won't help him. And a Catholic priest comes along and won't help him. And, a political guy comes along and won't help him. But then you get a guy that everybody despises. It was a Muslim came along, and he stopped and helped him. And you're shocked by the behavior. Jesus shocks the people with the Good Samaritan, and God shocks these people with Jonah in the same way. I hope that makes sense. Like when you're reading, you're like, wait, this shouldn't be this way. He allows them to see their need to turn to God as they see positive responses from God's limited revelation. I mean, the Ninevites don't know anything about God. They've never been to seminary. They don't even have the book of Genesis. I mean, they've got nothing except a limited message from Jonah, and they turn. And so that's what it's about. I'm not going to turn to Matthew right now, but just to say in Matthew 12, Jesus talks about Jonah. Matthew 12 is a hinge chapter in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew is the Jewish Gospel. The other three are not. Matthew is probably the first Gospel, and throughout history, virtually everybody believed Matthew wrote the Gospel of Matthew is the first that was written, and that's changed recently. But he preaches to the Jewish people, and it's a hinge chapter, because in chapter 12, they say, this guy is doing all these miracles by the power of Beelzebub, the Lord of the Flies, Satan. And Jesus says, you know, you can be forgiven for a lot of things, but you deny the Holy Spirit's power in your midst, and you won't be forgiven. It's just a real hinge chapter. Only sign you're going to see is the sign of the prophet Jonah, who was in the belly of the well 3 days and three nights. God's resurrection of Christ will vindicate everything he said. But just know, I mean, when Jesus is talking about Jonah, he says the men of Nineveh, or the people of Nineveh, will rise in judgment against this generation because Jonah preached to them in the old days and they got in sackcloth and ashes and repented. But one greater than Jonah is here. Jesus thinks Jonah is a real person. Jesus thinks Jonah went to Nineveh. He thinks the Ninevites really repented, and I believe they got saved, they became believers, because they are now standing as witnesses against a future judgment of a generation of Jewish people that largely said no to Messiah when he came, and they murdered him for it. Think about that. And so it's just a powerful thing. He's historical. This Ezekiel passage, I'm not going to go and read it, but something God says to Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel's later in time. He's dealing with, he's a contemporary of Daniel. Let me just say this. When the people that are left and they've been taken to Babylon, God sends Ezekiel to preach to them. And God tells them ahead of time in the first two chapters of Ezekiel. He says, when you get there, they're not going to listen to you. I mean, you're just going to be like talking to a brick wall. You're going to preach your heart out. They're rebellious. And he says something real curious. He says, if I sent you to some other country whose language you don't even understand and had you preach to them, they would repent. I'm like, that's like Jonah. It's much later in time. But that's a sad commentary. If people who have maximal revelation like we do, most of us own more than one Bible. I've watched videos of people in other countries getting a Bible for the first time. They've been reached through missionaries, and they're crying their eyes out because they finally have a Bible, such joy. We got a lot of Bibles, and they sit and collect dust, right? And God says, you have maximal revelation. You're responsible for it. Well, the man Jonah, his name means dove. There are three prophets in our Old Testament that speak at the same time period, basically. Jonah, Amos, and Hosea. Sometimes we don't realize that. We're looking through the books. All the other prophets speak to the south or to the whole country, like the earlier prophets. But Jonah, Amos, and Hosea all speak during this time of Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II and his time period. I mean, this guy reigns for 40 years. You can see the United States here. Okay? Bad rulers, material prosperity. Recent history. I mean, material prosperity. And that's who they are. This guy, Jeroboam II, is a terrible guy. He's named after the original Jeroboam. And throughout the when you're reading the history of Israel, it'll say, and they did the sins of Jeroboam. What's that? Idolatry. They went to the high places. What are they doing in the high places? You know what they're doing there. They're having sex with prostitutes because they think they can arouse Baal. And I mean, I'm saying this because we're not in a mixed group. Baal's going to excite himself, and that's rain, and that's how they'll get rain, okay? I mean, these people are bad. That's who they are, right? Baal's the guy that brings the rain to make the ground fertile. Jeroboam's awful. Instead of God turning off the spigot, making it not rain for a few years so they can look at how the crops are doing, God gives them a bounty. He allows them to expand their territory, and the economy's good, and they're getting 25% on their mutual funds. I mean, these guys are cooking. And here's these three guys. It's a threefold attack. And if you read Hosea, what does Hosea say? It says, first chapter, I'm going to have you go marry a prostitute, and she's going to betray you, Hosea. I want you to understand how it is to be me. Because God had married Israel and taken care of her and provided everything. And she's an idolater. Well, not a godly king, but they're most powerful. The boundaries were expanded. Probably Jonah preaches around 759 during the reign of Ashur-dan, which is the Assyrian guy. Israel was defeated about 40 years later in 722. That's recorded in the Bible, and it was bad. Meaning the northern kingdom was defeated. Now, the southern kingdom goes later, but they go under Nebuchadnezzar, different empire. Jesus referred to Jonah, as I said earlier. He believes Jonah is a historical person, even though scholars now don't. Let's look in chapter 1. We'll get a few verses out of the way, and we've only got about 5 minutes. So I just want to look at a couple of verses so we can say we actually opened the book of Jonah today. But I hope with some context this will help us. Look at Jonah 1, and then next week we'll finish all of Jonah 1. But the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai. That's how all prophets start off. They always say the word of God, the word of the Lord. Lord is King James, you know, does the capitalization different. It's Yahweh. The word of Yahweh came to Jonah. Jonah doesn't even respond here. When you read chapter 4, he'll tell you what his answer was. His answer was that he argued with God, like Peter did. Jesus said, I got to go to the cross. Peter said, no, I'm not letting you. Jesus says, stand behind me, Satan. This is Jonah. He'll argue with God, but didn't get recorded in the first chapter. Arise, go to Nineveh. When you read that, think Iraq. Just imagine even today going there with this message. Go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it. For their wickedness has come up before me. And their wickedness, we've seen the pictures. I mean, these guys are just bad. They're idolaters and they're murderers. But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And Tarshish is in Spain. You saw the map earlier. Nineveh is kind of northeast. Tarshish is due west. And it's a long trip. And what I want to end with as we come to close is this question. I get why he doesn't want to go to Iraq. I wouldn't want to go either. I wouldn't want to go to Afghanistan, but God might lead me to go to London. Right? God might lead me to go to a lot of places, but not Afghanistan or Iraq or North Korea. I think that's how we think. And you can see why he didn't go, but here's my question. Why did he run? Why would he try to go all the way to Spain? They don't speak Hebrew there. What do you think?
Get as far away from God as he could.
Yeah, get as far away from God as he could. You know what it's as old as the garden. What happens in Genesis 3? You know, the woman takes the fruit from the tree of knowledge. Supposed to make her smart. That wasn't quite right. She knows more, but now she knows sin experientially, and so does Adam. But when God comes to the garden, what does he do? God calls him, Adam, where are you? I'm hiding. You ever played hide-and-go-seek with a five-year-old? You can always see them because they always look from where they're hiding. Like Adam's really going to hide from God. Guess it's not Adam's garden. He just tills the ground there. But why'd he run? Here's the deal. Our first reaction when we get our tails in a crack and we do something we really shouldn't have, and especially if it's a habit we can't break, is usually to run from God. And the way that looks nowadays is people start coming to church. I've known people be in church a long time, seem to be pillars. All of a sudden, they got some marriage problems or something else, or guy feels like he's hitting the bottle too much, and he's gone. He's doing the opposite of what God says to do. See, our problems when we fall out with God need to draw us back to God. That's what it says in James, draw near to me and I'll draw near to you. That's what we need. That's how we get restored. Just have that in mind. Yeah, James 4 is such a simple verse. You draw near to me, I'll draw near to you. And I'm like, you know, people say, well, how do I get to know God better? Get closer to him. Well, Jonah runs the other way. And Jonah is Israel. And they're going to run. And they're going to run and run all the way to a dead end, but God's going to chase them. And that's why I call this series Chasing Jonah. He'll chase you and I too when we run.